Okay, so now we'll have the parade of short talks. So the sequence will be as follows: Eric Gotthelf, Keith Lockage, David Nice, Reno Bandera, Noriaki Shibazaki, Brian Gainsler, Insung Su, and Adam Burrows. So, Eric.
1 minute each.
Yeah, so it might help for the others to line up. Even though it sort of looks a bit uncouth.
Okay, this is a busy view graph, but this is about the discovery of a pulsar in KES-75, and it turns out it's a very interesting. First of all, this field here. Where's this?
Sorry, I got three new customers in the meantime.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. So anyhow, this field is the OSCA GIS field of KES-73 that was taken in 1993, and it was to look for pulsations. There are expected to be pulsations here. KES-75 quickly is a radio supernova remnant with a core, one of the few where you have example of actually a core, a kind of flareon core, and a shell. And it was assumed that there should be a pulsar in there. And we went and looked at OSCA, and we didn't find one. But instead, a little time later, we found a pulsar here, which was unknown. And that was a 7-second pulsar. And that was very interesting. So we went back to look at the field, and this pulsar disappeared. Instead, we found pulsations at 0.3 seconds. And after, with XTE, and that was a very definite detection, so looked around the area where, you know, big field of view, looked in all the XTE data, all the OSCA data, and it wound up coming just from here. And then when we do phase resolved imaging, I mean, you can see it just, this is actually it. It's, no, actually not this picture, but it stands up right there. That was the pulsar. It's 0.3 seconds. Spinning down, there's lots of data. Once you find a period, you can go back and you find in all the other data. And it's spinning down very rapidly, very young, very high magnetic field, and properties that make it very special, I think.
Yeah. Thanks.
Come see the poster.
Yeah.
It's a great result, Eric. Thank you. Keith.
Well, can I suggest that you actually get to the result without any introduction, because there's not much time.
Okay, so this is just an ad for the poster. So we were looking at the rotationally restored modes of relativistic stars. And this is work done in collaboration with Niels Andersen and John Friedman. So the reason for doing this is R modes have been studied only in Newtonian stars, and in particular the time scales on which the R mode instability grows has been calculated only using post-Newtonian theory. So we wanted to see what the modes look like in fully relativistic stars, and we wanted to see whether the time scales would be affected much in the full theory. And what we have, so we have a calculation that finds the rotationally restored modes in relativistic stars. In order to find the modes, we first had to clarify some subtleties concerning the oscillation spectrum, the low frequency oscillation spectrum of relativistic stars. And so this is what we've completed so far, and we're just on the verge of computing the relativistic timescales. We should have that fairly soon. So.
David, nice.
Okay, I'm a pretty simple person, so all this discussion about R modes and changing magnetic field configurations is a bit too complicated for me. I'd prefer to know just what the masses of these stars are in the first place. And if you look at my poster in the back left corner, you'll see
from radio pulsar observations of two binary systems, new upper limits on the masses of neutron stars. In one case, an upper limit of 2.0 solar masses, which should go down in the next year or so. And in the other case, an upper limit of 1.5 solar masses. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thanks. Where's Reno? Oh, okay. I can have this.
The same.
There are no images, the images are there. Just a short list of, first of all, what was known before in the Crab Nebula. The point, the basic point in the, is that in the radio, the spectral index was very highly homogeneous, and that was taken as an indication that there was. There was a single acceleration process of electrons, and while the fact that in the optical and X-rays, and anyway, at frequencies above the evolutive break frequency, which is 10 to the 13 Hertz, there was some spectral variation that was explained, at least qualitatively, in terms of synchrotron downgrading. Now, our result is that by comparing the map we got at 1.3 millimeters with the radio map, but a map that anyway below the break frequency, that's an important point, we see that the shape of the Crab Nebula is not exactly the extrapolation of the shape in radio, and but we find an additional component, and that's it's rather similar qualitatively with that shape and the size with that seen in X-rays. And moreover, in order to have what has been observed in the radio, so a homogeneous spectral index, we need that this component has some sort of a low frequency cutoff. And if you count the number of particles, emitting particles, if rather close to what was predicted by Ken and Coronetti, this may be suggestive, even though a lot of theoretical work should be done in that direction. And finally, for the filament that has seen in the synchrotron radio map, we see that there is a bending that can be measured in the millimetric range, and from that one can find derive the average magnetic field and in the filaments. Okay, that's all.
Okay. Okay. It's Nuria Shibazaki. Now, I must tell you that the most imaginative astronomer I know is Marco Tavani, who put one view graph and then he had 12 others which are pasted, and so he just put one on top of each other. We haven't yet seen that.
We have.
I was just trying to put it up. You want the people to look.
We have studied the vortex configuration, the oscillation, and spinning in neutral star paths. And sorry for that. And this is a configuration of on the vortex line, and what kinks are formed, you know, here the vortex line kinks are formed, and in this part, you know, the vortex are pinned to a lattice nuclei. And this is the result. Sorry for that. And, lengths of the kink of Arkanov are 7 times the lattice constant. And we need about 8 million electrons to form one kink. And recently, P.B. Jones said because of the kink motion, there will be no pinning. But we think it may, in order to have such kind of situation, we need to supply the kink every hour, every 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So this may be a difficulty for the model. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Brian Gaines.
Well,
in one case, Jeff Stafford and I have a poster on Cooper's A. There is a neutron star in the center of that remnant. And one wants to know what it is. But we did a deep radio search for any nebula surrounding that remnant on a wide range of scales, and we saw absolutely nothing. And explaining the poster, that from that you can infer the properties of the pulsar wind, we come to the conclusion either that it has no wind at all, that it's some other exotic object, or that it has long period and a rather high magnetic field. At the other end of things, the second poster we have is on supernova remnant G328.4+0.2, which is a baryon which no one really has paid much attention to. If you actually measure its radio flux and measure its distance, it turns out it's the most luminous baryon in the galaxy. It's twice as luminous as the crab.
Ben.
It's also absolutely...
It's twice as luminous as the crab, and it's also... huge. It's 25 parsecs across. So you've got this enormous, incredibly luminous baryon, and you have to ask yourself what sort of pulsar is powering it. And if you do all the calculations, you find out that the only way this can really hang together is if you have a very low magnetic field pulsar, a few by 10 to the 11 Gauss, with a very rapid period of about 15 milliseconds. If you go look through the catalogue and see if there are any other baryons which fit this sort of properties and calculate the expected properties of their pulsar, you find there are two others, CDB87 and N157B, which actually does happen to have a 16 millisecond low field pulsar. So we speculate that there could be this small category of large, very luminous baryons powered by low field pulsars. Thank you.
Okay, Ensign Su.
Here I calculate the strong magnetic field effect on the neutron star, strongly magnetized neutron star internal property, that is equation of state and structure. In order to do this, I used the degenerate the ideal MP gas model with anomalous magnetic moment, and after that I calculate the proton concentration in the very important in cooling mechanism, and after that I calculate the neutron drip density. Ordinary star have a neutron density 10 to 12 gram per cubic centimeter, but this neutron drip density will change the by magnetic field, and after that I calculate the muon and the pion muon and the pion appearance density, and finally I calculate the equation of state with this MP gas model. Then I found the adiabatic index and with oscillation. This oscillation will give a pulsational instability, and I consider pion condensation in a strong magnetic field, and I try to calculate mass radius relation in with ideal MP gas model, and details are in the poster, and you can find the details in the this my clipping.
Okay, Corey Hilbreth.
As everybody knows, there's work, and there has been a lot of work in both the sources and opacity in for neutrino processes, in especially in young neutron stars. But as we hear from Professor Tsuruta, it may be important as for the cooling of older objects as well. So we decided to take a closer look at some left very issues on neutrino remnant star. So the problem here is that along the years that people have faced consistently that even the one pion exchange approximation, the very complicated dependence of the moment of a transfer moment there, complicated calculation. And actually what we have done is that some time ago and just appear in physical review C. In the most rough approximation of putting a constant, the square of a matrix element as a constant, which is the same thing as taking the high momentum limit, Todd Thompson, Adam Burrows, and me publish some results that go from the extremely non-degenerate and to the extreme degenerate limit in that approximation. And now we have been able to find that under certain approximations, which is essentially to keep the temperature low enough, below 20 MeV, which is a limit that applies in most of the situations, we have been able to calculate the full momentum dependence of that process, and we find that in the non-degenerate limit, a correction of two-thirds of the our former rate, and in the highly degenerate limit, asymptotically, two-ninths of the high, its high momentum limit. So at least in this particular class of matrix element interactions, we have been able to go slightly beyond the very rough approximations, and we plan to extend on that kind of calculations to see which accurate results can come up. Thank you.
Marcelo Allen. Well, it should be.
Hello, hello. Okay, we are studying pulsar spin down with two components. As long as one is linear and with omega and the other is cubic, regardless of details, you have an evolution that the breaking index goes from 3 to 1 and high magnetic field pulsars quickly goes down on P dot and then starts increasing, and in 10 to 4 years they will be in the SGRXP region. A low B pulsar will take so much time to do all the track that we will see a lot of pulsars in this region, and then they go up as the other one. Thank you.
Andrea Lohmann.
Don't worry, I have no intention of explaining all of this. But this is my poster, which you can see in the back, and I time radio pulsars for a living. And in particular, this is data from 2.5 years of Arecibo millisecond pulsars. And one of the things that millisecond pulsar timing and pulsar timing in general hangs its hat on is the stability of pulse profile shapes. And what I'm looking for here is shape changes in pulse profiles of the sort that have been observed by Michael Kramer recently. And the result, the bottom line or the result is we do not see profile changes on levels of 10 to 15% in 11 millisecond pulsars at Arecibo. And the idea is to get the levels of these pulsar timing, the precision down to sub 100 nanosecond level. It's now at about a microsecond, so that we can measure gravitational waves and also start to get at the timing noise that Andrew Lyon was talking about yesterday in millisecond pulsars. Thanks.
John Giro.
Actually, we discussed in this meeting young neutron stars are more discovered by X-ray observation. So we did look at the three supernova remnants to hope to found new neutron stars. And and also the Pleiadian supernova remnant. OK, this is one case. I think it's quite positive result. In fact, the image is the radio contour, the image, and contour is the X-rays. As you can see here, the X-ray point source, point-like compact source are well centered at the center of supernova remnant. Okay, that's one evidence. Second evidence is the spectrum is very hard. So that's quite good sign. We are still attempting to search for the period, the time variabilities. What else could it be? Okay, this is the second case. So you will see again the radio image. It's very weird structure of the arc, and we seem to see similar shell structures and possibly some compact emission related to that compact source, which has radio in very flat radio index. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Herman Marshall.
I'd like to show a high-resolution X-ray spectrum of a radio pulsar. The first thing to see is what not to see, which is this end over here. That's probably due to high orders and the gratings that you can't tell from low energy real photons. The main point here is that this is an adaptive binning spectrum where we are comparing to a black body here, black body spectrum, and we see what appears to be a power law on this end and then some deviations from the black body in here, which are not modeled. And they're essentially unknown origin right now, at around quarter keV, where this dip is right in here. We're currently still working. This feature right in here is in the effective area of the instrument at around a quarter keV. So this is the only one that I really, I believe, is likely to end up being real when we finish up the calibration of the low energy gratings effective area.
Thanks. Okay, well, I couldn't resist asking a question, Herman. You said we should ignore most of those counts that you showed.
No, only low energy, very low, okay. Below 0.25 kV.
Was that phase average?
Yes, it was phase average.
Okay, so Adam will. Yeah, I don't know how to. Lights off, please.
I brought a few movies related to supernovae. I'm going to show just two. The first one is shown here. What it is in fact a little different from the subject of this conference. It's a type 1a supernova explosion in a binary where the explosion is hitting the companion. That blue dot is the secondary star. It could be, in this case, it's a main sequence star, about one solar mass. And the supernova comes off the top. We put in realistic structures of the supernova blast. We put in realistic stellar profiles, and we separated them by, you know, put it in with Roche geometry. And you can see there are quite a number of interesting phenomena associated with this, one of which is, of course, that the star itself is disrupted. You evaporate from the surface. You get all this complicated filigree of the evaporation, complicated Mach stems and shock structures, exciting non-radial modes of various sorts. You leave behind a star that's puffed up. You also strip a fair amount of hydrogen. And if this is a 1A, you have to ask where it is in the spectrum. That's another subject. It also implies that if there's a companion, that the supernova remnant, all else being equal, is going to be distorted on one side. Since we're in a hurry.
This was a 2D.
Yes, it's 2D. It has all sorts of problems. But it was done in cylindrical symmetry, but it was axial symmetry. But otherwise, it's has some virtue to it.
What does the color factor represent?
As density. So blue is high density and red is low density. And there are a lot of movies that can show the various other things. For example, compositions and distinguish. But I'm not sure that we really have time to go through that. In this particular case, it's about 15% of the mass. Most of it is hydrogen and helium. It's stripped at low velocities, not at supernova velocities, but 800 kilometers per second, and will represent the creamy center of the supernova residue. So it's you might be able to see this hydrogen after 300 to 500 days of after the supernova explosion, but you won't see it at peak. Okay. Now this next one. Yes. is this one other people have seen before. Let me stop this. This is just the inner 150 kilometers of a core collapse. The bottom left is the center of the protoneutron star. The white line is the neutrino sphere. This whole thing lasts for about 400 milliseconds, and you can see the convective motion to which I was referring. The yellow orange region is the shock, so you can see it's not spherical. There are all sorts of plumes, but this thing goes unstable. As you can see, it blows up. When it blows up, it does not blow up spherically. There's all sorts of continuing motions, highly vigorous transonic convective motions. You see a blob fell in this calculation, but it was immediately blown away because after the supernova, there's the wind that follows, and you're seeing the wind coming off the protoneutron star. I'll let it go once more. You can see material falling in. The inner region is becoming neutron rich. This is actually a YE plot, so the yellow material is symmetric matter, normal material, and blue is the neutronized material. Again, those tsunamis moving along the surface in this intermediate region because of the plumes hitting the surface, exciting it. And yes, this is in 2D. There's all sorts of interesting phenomenology associated with this calculation and perhaps with the physics.
The lights on. Okay. One request for those of you who gave these short presentations, you can give as many slides as you want for digitizing on the web. There's no limit on that at all. So please do that, in fact, because that way there'll be a record of this session.